Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I come to you weekly with a critical, independent voice on the politics and practice of health. Most people know that stress kills, but when discussing chronic disease, victims are blamed for lifestyle improprieties. Is it really possible to talk about lifestyle choices if people living in poverty have no choices? What if you have to take 2 buses to buy fresh produce and then find prices higher than at suburban markets? And what then if you can get a Happy Meal down the block for 99 cents? Can you exercise outside when people are getting shot in your neighborhood? So maybe this isn't happening in your neighborhood. Are they getting ready to spray your neighborhood for a moth with a product that's killing children and making adults sick for 90 days after? How much stress does it take to reduce a lifespan by 10 years? Is it access to health care or lack of control that shortens the lives of so many Americans? Join us today as we discuss longevity and socioeconomic stress as presented on the PBS special Unnatural Causes. First, an editorial about this week's health news by Jeffrey Fawcett, Ph.D.
Thank you, Lena. Financial and economic ministers from around the world met this last Sunday in Washington, D.C., and, of all things, talked about food. This might have been a way to dodge talking about crumbling conditions in the world's capital markets. But something more imminent seemed to be on their minds. The president of the International Monetary Fund said, quote, "As we know in the past, sometimes those questions lead to war. We now need to devote 100% of our time to these questions," end quote. These questions refers to the political instability caused by rising food prices in nations such as Haiti, Egypt, the Philippines, Niger, and up to 36 others, and how to prevent that instability from toppling those nations' governments. Robert Zoellick, former U.S. representative to the World Trade Organization and now president of the World Bank, said, quote, "We have to put our money where our mouth is now so we can put food into hungry mouths," end quote. The answer that these men offered to these questions revolved around how to increase the commitment of industrialized nations to funding food aid to poor nations. No one talked about how to enable the people of these nations to return to their traditional agricultural practices so that they will be self-sufficient as well as return to their traditional diets. Instead, their solution is to export crops produced in overabundance by agribusinesses in industrialized countries, supported by government subsidies sent to a handful of farmers whose mailing addresses are in Manhattan. A real answer to these questions presented itself at the same time that the world's financial bigwigs were wringing their hands. One of the 6 winners of the Goldman Environmental Prize, Jesus Leon Santos, is revitalizing traditional agricultural practices in Oaxaca, Mexico. Starting over 20 years ago with a small tree planting project, his organization is reversing the erosion that started with the European invasion 500 years ago, stopping the outmigration of people from the region devastated by the North American Free Trade Agreement, and returning native food crops to cultivation. We know it as sustainable agriculture. The 1,500 farmers in this movement use manure, not chemical fertilizer. They don't use pesticides, and there isn't a GMO crop in sight. They're not following these practices out of an environmental consciousness, as we urbanized folk would understand it. They're doing it because it empowers them. Although the Oaxacan farmers receive some outside support, it's the day-to-day magic of people supporting each other, using local knowledge, and strengthening their way of life that has made this movement a success. Compare and contrast. Wealthy nations dropping surplus commodities on hungry people displaced from their traditional agricultural practices by the very organizations responsible in whole or in part for creating these emergency conditions, versus people working together to restore the productivity of their land through traditional agricultural practices. It's top-down versus bottom-up. The Oaxacan farmers' solution is such a good one that other farmers from around the world, including some in the United States, are talking to them. The Sustainable Health Institute advocates just such solutions from the bottom up. It's about people using local knowledge to build a thriving community. It's about sharing that knowledge among communities. And while outside support is often critical in creating healthy communities, medical interventions, the equivalent of importing subsidized food to put into hungry mouths, whether conventional or alternative, are not the answer. Handy for an emergency, but not for sustainability. The economic, intellectual, and emotional resources that sustain our health are the ones that feed our strength. A transcript of this editorial is available at the blog at yourownhealthandfitness.org. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. Take care of yourself.
Dr. Jeff Fawcett, Ph.D., is an environmental economist, writer, and health educator who produces the show with me and is director of the Sustainable Health Institute at sustainablehealthinstitute.org. Now to our topic for today, longevity and socioeconomic stress, and my guest, physician Anthony Iton. It's I-T-O-N. He is Alameda County Public Health Department Director and Health Officer. Dr. Iton's primary interest is in the health of disadvantaged populations and the contributions of race, class, health, education, geography, and employment to health status. He asserts that only sustainable approaches to eliminating health inequities can be done through the design of intensive multi-sectorial place-based interventions that are specifically designed to identify existing assets and build social, political, and economic power among a critical mass of community residents in historically under-resourced communities. Dr. Iton received his medical degree at Johns Hopkins Medical School and subsequently trained in internal medicine and preventative medicine at New York Hospital, Yale, and Berkeley, and is board certified in both specialties. Dr. Iton also received a law degree and a master's of public health from the University of California, Berkeley, and is a member of the California Bar. He has worked as an HIV disability rights attorney at the Berkeley Community Law Center, a healthcare policy analyst with Consumers Union West Coast Regional Office, and as a physician and advocate for the homeless at the San Francisco Public Health Department, among many other wonderful things. And he is a participant in this four-part series that's been airing on PBS called Unnatural Causes. And we're very, very lucky to have you on the air, Dr. Iton.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, it's really a pleasure. I really am impressed and pleased with the work that you're doing. It makes me feel like the world is a better place. When we talked, you made mention that it's easier for people to understand the problem when they hear the statistics, so I'd like you to go ahead with that.
Well, I think that there are many forces in our society that are largely invisible to people. And the longer you spend sort of operating under those forces, the more they become sort of second nature to you. And it's difficult at times to make it visible to people how disease is not randomly distributed throughout societies. And one of the ways in which we try to make it visible to people is by mapping the incidence and prevalence, in other words, the rates and occurrence of disease in geographic areas. And when you do that, you find some very striking and disturbing patterns. And we're talking now about mapping major causes of illness and death, like heart disease, stroke, cancer, and then life expectancy itself, the length of life that people can expect to live in certain neighborhoods. And for instance, if you look at a person in West Oakland who's of African American heritage, they are more than likely going to die 15 years earlier than someone Caucasian born in the Oakland Hills. And 15 years of life is pretty significant. What's particularly disturbing about it is that when you look back over time, you see that that gap, that absolute disparity in length of life is increasing. And so while these patterns are distributed in ways that are predictable, we're also seeing a worsening of the patterns.
I had just one comment before you go on to explain the patterns and a little bit more, which is that I believe there's a very common misconception among most middle-class people, which is that the problems of the, quote, underserved, close quote, is that they have no access to health care, and that that's why they're dying younger. And what the PBS special on natural causes points out across the board is that it isn't a lack of access to health care. We live in, I mean, they may have a different access to health care than people with money, but the access to health care is not saving people with the money and resources to take advantage of it. I mean, America is, what is it, 30th?
Yeah.
Among all the, is it, it's not just industrial, it's 30th among all the nations, I think, in the world, in how long we live and how, you know, infant mortality and whatnot. So, as I said, most people think, oh, well, they just don't have enough health care. But that isn't what we're finding with these, with this research that's being done.
Yes, that's in fact true. And let me just say right out that health care is important. And everyone should have access to a high-quality system of health care that is affordable and accessible. And we are nowhere close to that in this country. But even if we did have that, the particular patterns in life expectancy, in the rates of chronic disease, heart disease, cancer, stroke, wouldn't be changed in any significant way by access to health care. And A Natural Causes does a very nice job of laying that out, the research support for that understanding of the role of healthcare is substantial. And healthcare probably plays somewhere on the order of 10 to 15% in trying to understand what makes a difference in these life expectancies that we're seeing. One of the commentators in Natural Causes, Ichiro Kawachi at Harvard, makes the point that saying that healthcare is the cure for a disease is like saying because aspirin cures a fever, that lack of aspirin must be the cause of fever. Well, lack of healthcare is not the cause of disease. It's one of the ways to approach curing it. But ideally, you would like to prevent it and delay it in the first place. And the healthcare system has a role in that, but not nearly as significant a role as one would like to think.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, there's also some discussion about the fact that some immigrants to the United States actually had reasonable health when they arrived, and then their health declines partly because of the types of neighborhoods that they're living in and the loss of control over their lives and access to things that keep you healthy. Again, with us being 30th, you have to think that some of the undeveloped nations actually, I mean, Africa's an example, actually. We think of Africa as being plagued with a lot of disease, but, I mean, yes, they have some issues, you know, but heart disease and cancer are not as, not nearly, I mean, it's just not, it's, especially when they're eating their native diet in Africa, they tend not to have those problems. So it isn't just, as you were saying, healthcare, access to healthcare should be a right of all human beings, but it doesn't, it isn't the primary problem. So as you discuss these patterns of disease distribution and why these, you know, if you could continue and sort of explain why they're predictable.
Well, you know, one would expect, I mean, basically the way we approach health in this country is that we equate health and healthcare. And one would therefore expect that given the amount of expenditures that we make on health care, that we would have extremely good health. And in fact, that is not the case, as you're pointing out. So, you know, a curious person tries to understand why that is not the case. And when you look at the data on the distribution of disease, you find that certain communities are disproportionately burdened by disease. And then you have to ask yourself a question about why is that? And the first answer typically that people assert is that, well, you know, these are poor places. There's probably a lot of homicide and a lot of exotic disease like AIDS and tuberculosis. And so when you look a little bit more deeply at the data and you subtract out, you know, what one might perceive as being somewhat, you know, unusual causes of death like homicide or HIV/AIDS, you find that that is really not the driver of the disparities in these communities. The driver is really chronic disease. It's heart disease, it's cancer, it's stroke, it's chronic lower respiratory disease. And the next thing people will say is, well, you know, it's because people in those places are bad people. They smoke, they drink, they're poorly behaved, and so the consequences of their behavior really is this premature disease and death rate. Well, you only have to look at the data again and see certain things. Yes, in fact, there are somewhat higher rates of what we consider to be risk behaviors in certain communities, smoking, drinking, driving without a seatbelt, etc. But when you look at populations that are equal smoking level, in other words, if you control for smoking, you control for these risk behaviors, you find that living in certain communities is an additional risk factor independent of any of your own behaviors on your length of life. And that's been shown all over the world and in many societies. So there's something about living in certain places that has nothing to do with what the individual does to him or herself that puts that individual and the communities in those areas at a higher risk of early death and chronic disease. And that's what needs to be explained by people in public health, and that's what we're trying to do.
You're listening to an interview with Anthony Eitan, physician and lawyer and public health official. We're discussing longevity and socioeconomic stress and the PBS special on natural causes. Indeed, there's a very chilling story in the third episode or installment of a man from Laos who does not have a history of early heart disease in his family at all and came to the United States and managed to get a house in Richmond and then realized Richmond was not a happy place to live and wanted to move them out and inevitably couldn't afford it and ended up back in Richmond and ended up with one child being on drugs and another child being shot to death at the door, mistakenly. And so he had a heart attack at 49. And what this illustrates is that the main culprit in the chronic diseases that we normally think of as being genetic or being because people have bad behavior are really connected up very powerfully to stressors, extreme stressors, including environmental stressors, emotional stressors, all stressors, that diseases like diabetes and heart disease are not an inevitable thing that gets passed on to family members, but is very much tied to a complete loss of control of place and of the things that nurture people's souls, community, place. I mean, the Pima Indians being another example where they've lost their water rights and can't farm, and they're giving subsidized food to them, and the subsidized food has no relationship to anything they should be eating at all, either because of the way they are, what they're used to eating, their how much they've evolved to eat or whatever, but it's also the food that really can't be used. It's an excess of sugar and white flour and just things that are nasty for most people to eat, and especially for these people to eat, and they all have diabetes.
Right.
And in fact, there was a project done. I think, Jeff, did you speak to Dr. Eitan about the Pimas? But you actually did some research into the project that happened where the Pima Indians were allowed to go back to their native diets. Do you want to explain that?
Well, there's a neighboring tribe, the Tohono, who lives south of the Gila River, where the Pimas themselves, the Pimas and the Tohono are related. But one of the things that unfortunately isn't discussed in this particular segment of the natural causes is that many of the Tohono are trying to recover their traditional agriculture and their traditional diets. And in fact, there was a comparison of a related tribe across the border with Mexico. who had control over their agriculture, were using traditional methods, and their diabetes rates were dramatically lower, dramatically different from the Tohono.
That's right. And in fact, the filmmakers tried to tell that story and ran into some technical difficulties in being able to essentially tell the Mexican side of the story. Uh-huh. That was their original intent, was to tell that story.
That's a really important part of the story. I mean, it also speaks to the fact that when exercise has to be performed as something extra, it's harder for people to do it. But if it's just built into their environment, as you've said too, I mean, worried about getting someone to go out and walk. Well, what is their environment like? Can they walk in their environment? And also, what is their lifestyle? Are they stuck in commuter traffic and then working inside a building all day long?
Right. So, I think that, you know, what is evolving is just a deeper understanding of human physiology.
Yes.
And how the external environment, which was thought to be sort of separate and distinct from, you know, the internal environment, which would be controlled by genes and, you know, things that people do to themselves. But the external environment, how people perceive the external environment, influences their internal physiology. And one of the clearest ways in which this happens is through this chronic stress pathway, wherein hormones in the individual are chronically elevated. Cortisol and other hormones that are essentially have an oxidative effect on the body and the body's tissues. And chronically over time, this causes wear and tear on the body that is essentially commensurate with the extent to which these hormones are persistently elevated. So you see this very clear gradient between those that essentially have relatively low stress existences compared to those that have intermediate stress existences, and then those with very high stress existences. And this gradient we call the social gradient, it relates very clearly to social class and to other aspects of social status. And the thing that's particularly difficult for many of us to understand and accept is that much of this is preventable. And policies that are geared towards essentially decoupling the consequences of poverty from health outcomes are available to us. And yet we seem to ignore this, where other countries have made very diligent and explicit efforts to create social policies that, in essence, lessen the consequences of poverty and decrease stress.
Well, it's, I think, difficult to convince corporations and large agra that this is everybody's problem economically and socially. It's hard to say to someone who's worried about the bottom line, spending money in this way will make you money in the long run. It's also kind of interesting because in our current political environment, there's a very frightening rate of a shrinking middle class, a widening gap, and many people who were, you know, not wealthy but comfortably middle class are that's gone. I mean, it's my observation is that most middle class people are now working extremely hard. They may not be working two jobs, they may not be commuting on a bus, but they're working much harder than they ever did before, and they are in a state of hypervigilance, and they are suffering from diseases of hyperarousal and inflammation, and heart disease in all groups, and diabetes in all groups are going up. So I think that the importance of looking at the underclass is so-called underclass is really to say, what are the conditions that kill us all, and how is it that anybody suffering this way in our society is a cause for all of us to be suffering? Do you want to comment?
Yeah, I think that was well stated. I just wanted to just make one small correction, and that is that heart disease rates are actually going down in most populations. Diabetes rates are going up, and they're compensating for the decrease in heart disease rates. And so the explanation for that, we do think, is related to both the physical environment and the, you know, increasing sedentary lifestyles that have been programmed into our existences, and this stress differential that goes across society. But you're also absolutely right that there's a cost, a big cost to society as a whole, and we'll continue to see this in terms of our economic productivity. For those who believe that the United States should strive to and maintain its current economic position in the world, they will be dismayed to see that we will no longer be able to maintain the rates of productivity that we have been able to maintain over the past few generations due to this increasing burden of chronic illness. These rates of disease cost us. They cost us in productivity. They cost us in the ability for people to essentially achieve to their level of potential. And that means that other societies will bypass us. They will become more productive. They'll become more creative. They will have less cost, you know, internally to manage their, you know, their greatest resource, which is their people. And we will have a high cost burden that we will be toting around with us as we try to compete. And ultimately, we will lose. And it'll be too late at that point to reverse course.
Well, on an sort of obvious way, taxpayers are in fact paying for the emergency room visits that people who can't afford health care have when they're in an emergency situation. And again, if their life conditions were appropriate so that their stress levels, I posit that diabetes is a disease of stress more than anything else, much more than lifestyle. I've seen people who have reasonable lifestyles who are developing diabetes because they're stressed out of their minds. So elevated blood sugar is like this, you know, mobilization of fight or flight. That may sound simplistic to you because you're a physician, but...
Well, no, there's actually some good physiological research that suggests that that is true.
But
and that we should think about it in that way and not just too much sugar leads to... an overwhelming of the insulin system, but also this notion of insulin resistance and the, you know, the constant hypersecretion of cortisol and other hormones leads to these metabolic problems.
But the other thing the taxpayers are paying for is they're paying for these agricultural subsidies, which means that people who probably some of these people who could be farming have small farms, are completely driven out of the market. It means that immigrants are coming here from other countries because they can't sell their products on the market because of the American subsidies. We're paying for so many programs that are disabling everybody, that are subsidizing basically large corporations. And, you know, we see it again in situations where, for instance, it's not just the agricultural industry, but we see it in other industries where their needs, the needs of industry and corporations making money, trumps socioeconomic issues for people at risk who need to be sort of brought up, you know. I mean, having a capacity for people in this country to farm successfully, having access to land, it's the same issue with the situation with the Pimas where they've lost their water and they've lost their lands and then their native diet goes away and then they're suddenly eating subsidized corn syrup, you know. It seems on the surface of it so obvious what needs to happen, and yet, as we discussed in the show we did last week, people are barricading themselves in a kind of reverse quarantine by buying their own healthy products and thinking that they're safe, but you're not safe if there are still neighborhoods that are being destroyed by industry. And that may be a step further than you wanted to go, but...
Well, I mean, I do think it speaks to a larger political question, political in the small p sense, not in the partisan political sense, and that is... Is our democracy really working? We've seen this in, you know, healthcare reform and the overwhelming support and sentiment amongst the populace that universal healthcare is a right. And when asked over and over again, decade after decade, people support that concept. Yet when the concept is brought to the political forum for debate and, you know, construction of some sort of system, it's overwhelmingly defeated by moneyed interests. And what you're describing with the farm bill and the agribusiness lobby is repeated over and over again with the health insurance lobby and healthcare reform, and I'm sure any number of different systems that you've talked about on your show. And so the question becomes for people who are interested in seeing change, how do you mobilize alliances across disciplines, across issue areas that are fundamentally trying to address the same flaw in the democratic process? And I think that that's going to be the challenge for people in public health and in other endeavors that are looking to essentially make our democracy work.
We're going to need to take a brief break in about a minute, but I would like you to begin to talk about the vision that you have for this.
Okay.
Now we don't have a minute left. I'm sorry. Let me do this. Let's come back from break. with you discussing some of the ways that we can mobilize not only public policy people, but even individuals, and because that's a big part of this too. So this is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, PhD. We're on the phone with Anthony Iton, MD, JD, and MPH. His name is spelled I-T-O-N. We're discussing socioeconomic stress and longevity as presented on the PBS special Unnatural Causes. We're going to take a very brief break, and we'll be right back with more of this interview. Stay put.
After one whole quart of brandy, like a daisy I'm awake. With no Broma seltzer handy, I don't even shake. Men are not a new sensation, I've done pretty well, I think. But this half-pint imitation put me on the blink. I'm wild again, beguiled again. A simpering, whimpering child again. Bewitched, bothered, and bewildered am I.
Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, PhD, and we are on the line with Dr. Anthony Iton, I-T-O-N. We are discussing longevity and socioeconomic stress as presented on the PBS special Unnatural Causes. And unfortunately, just as I went to break, I asked Dr. Iton to talk a bit about his vision for the future in terms of mobilizing our democracy so that everybody's protected and that so that the middle class doesn't end up in this long slide into chronic illness as well.
Yes, well, I want to say first off that my quote-unquote vision is a shared vision. There is an organization called the Bay Area Regional Health Inequities Initiative, or BARHI, which is eight Bay Area health departments that have come together to address what we consider to be issues of social justice. And we have been working to strategize different approaches to, A, making what appears to be somewhat invisible visible, and coming up with concrete strategies to address it both within public health and then across disciplines. So the first thing that we've recognized that needs to be done is that these places that have been systematically deprived, both presently and over time due to a legacy of discrimination based on race and class and a number of different statuses, these places need a different kind of public health approach. And traditionally what we've done is we've worked with individuals and we've created programs where individuals are entitled to, you know, a certain basket of supports, and we've fostered a real climate of dependency. And you know, with well-meaning dependency, but dependency nonetheless. And what is clear is that, and this comes through in Unnatural Causes, particularly around immigrant populations, is that many of these communities are smarter about working together, maintaining social cohesion, building social capital, than is the larger society. And we've ignored the lessons of that because we're essentially arrogant. And working in these communities to build social, political, and economic power is the first thing that we need to do. And we need to do that in a way that respects cultural practices, respects what people know from their experience in these communities, and we need to support them with resources that they have the discretion to shape and use, not resources that we say you can have this if you behave in this way, but flexible resources, similar to what's been going on in other parts of the world, the developing world, with microcredit and you know, creating cooperatives. It's allowing people to use their natural entrepreneurial instincts to support themselves, their families, and their neighbors. So that's the first thing that we need to do. We also need to re-engage them in the local political process and to organize them in ways that local political processes are held more accountable to their needs.
I might mention that if people miss parts of this interview for some reason, it's a full-hour version of this will be on our website at yourownhealthandfitness.org, and they can also reach us at 707-874-2772. In addition, people might be interested to go to the website for the production on natural causes, unnaturalcauses.org, and they've done a very interesting thing of having actually some tools on their website for people and resources there, too. What was the website that you referred to? Maybe you didn't. There was an organization that you mentioned.
Yes, BARHI, Bay Area Regional Health Inequities Initiative. That's BARHI, BARHII.org. And there are a couple of reports there, recent reports, one from BARHI about regional inequities in the Bay Area, and a number of different presentations that sort of speak to both the issues that have been identified and the strategies that are being worked out to try to confront this.
You know, I think what as Jeffrey talked about in the editorial, the Goldman Awards that were recently awarded really speak to the power of community organizing and grassroots organizing in communities, how powerful an effect that can have in cleaning up a neighborhood that's in major trouble.
Well, we also think that this is holding democracy accountable. Part of the reason our democracy doesn't work is because people feel, in essence, like they are not respected in the political process, and that, you know, despite their individual efforts, it seems that organized, moneyed forces have much more control over the process, and I think that's a pretty legitimate observation. But if you organize people well enough, and there are enough of them, even the greatest moneyed forces can't overwhelm that. So that's part of our thinking. It's not a purely political strategy. We also think that organized communities feel more personally empowered. Individuals within those communities feel more personally empowered. So that's part of our strategy, doing things in places that build social, political, and economic power. But that's not the entirety of our strategy. We also think that we need to look at the policy landscape and understand the impacts of some short-term focused policies on health. And in essence, we want to do health impact assessments of land use policies, of education policies, of employment policies, of wage and economic development policies, because these things have huge implications, particularly the way that the benefits of those policies are distributed across communities. They have huge compounding implications on health outcomes, and we think that that needs to be elucidated, and people need to see these relationships, particularly policymakers, and they need to be held accountable for them. And I'm not implying that there are policymakers trying to injure people in certain communities, but I do think that there's a fair amount of siloization where people operate in one domain and they don't think about the implications of that these policies on other domains, namely health. So we're trying to show those relationships and illustrate how these things are connected. But that's not all. There's more.
Let me just comment one thing. This is now starting to spill over into other neighborhoods, even affluent neighborhoods. And we see, forgive me if this is not in line, but with this light brown apple moth, the spraying that's being proposed, there's plenty of news that's been out, even in the Associated Press, even in the San Francisco Chronicle, that this moth is not considered a pest in New Zealand where it lives. I mean, they're not eradicating it. And here comes this product, which looks like it's going to be very irritating. It has already been irritating to other populations and children. And yet, it really looks like it's going to take an enormous consumer response, which there is. But we don't know if this is going to be pushed back. But they're planning on even spraying an affluent city like San Francisco. So some of these policies are affecting everybody now, not just people in Hunters Point and places like that.
Yeah, I think that, you know, there you've got a what is almost a purely political question about balancing the interests of the agricultural industry against the interests of the general consumer, who generally does not like being sprayed by airplanes with mysterious chemicals. And so I think that this is less of a health issue and more of a pure political issue. And what we need is good data, good information about the human health effects, good data, good information about the nature of the agricultural threat. And then a political decision needs to be made after a robust debate airing all of the facts and the interests.
Well, I bring it up only because I'm observing a lot of instances where corporations have more control than populations do, and it's increasingly becoming a situation for everybody. Like, another would be that there is expansion of wireless networks all over the place, very similar to having smoking in movie theaters and on airplanes. It's everywhere now, and the sightings of very large cell phone antenna arrays in neighborhoods where they're sited even conservatively too close to houses, and trying to back any of this down when consumers try to get active together to push on this issue, it's very difficult because there's laws in place like the Telecommunications Act that protects the telecommunications industry from these sorts of assaults instead of protecting people. So when you talk about some of these policies, it feels to me like the interests of big money have to be put second, and that the precautionary principle has to be put first for people's health to be improved in this country.
Well, I think you make an interesting point. I our work has been focused on equity and trying to ensure that the political process and the policymaking decision process is accountable to all segments of society. And what we see in health is that it's clearly not.
Yeah.
The interests of low-income people of color, of middle-class people, are routinely trounced mm-hmm. by the interests of, you know, you can call it corporate interests, you can call it the interests of wealthy, vested populations. The point is that the processes that are ostensibly designed to allow for a fair airing and a robust struggle over the allocation of precious social resources has not been working for low-income people of color, and arguably not for middle-class people in the United States, and the consequences of that in health are now being clearly laid out in documentaries like Unnatural Causes and in the work of many health departments around the country.
Do you see some good news on the horizon? I mean, do you see some policy things sort of changing? I know you guys are working, that there are several groups working on this, and they're certainly educating the public about it, although I wish the program wasn't on at 10 o'clock at night on a weeknight. But, you know, just having it available at all is very powerful. I think also having the public be told numerous times with very, very good examples that these chronic symptoms that are being construct these medicalization of these symptoms into diseases, like stress responses being dubbed as disease, which we try to suppress with medication to some extent instead of being able to address the underlying causes of asthma and diabetes and heart disease and all these things, that these are partially stress responses, partially stressors from the environment, filthy environments, black mold and all sorts of things. But there must be some good news. I know in Natural Causes there are things like they're teaching youth how to interact with a policy in their own areas politically, in their neighborhoods, and how to have, or even how to clean up areas themselves. So how do we empower all of us so that the health effects of helplessness, which are so corrosive, can be diminished or reversed?
Yeah, I think that that's the challenge, and there's lots of good news. You know, the first thing to keep in mind is that this is fundamentally a struggle over social justice. This is about holding systems accountable and allowing communities that have been essentially politically, socially, economically disenfranchised to have an opportunity to essentially compete in the marketplace of ideas and share in the resources that are available for all of us. So, in essence, this is not something that will end tomorrow. This is an ongoing struggle. As long as you have power, it's going to essentially distribute itself in ways that are unbalanced, particularly in an economic system such as the one we have that essentially encourages large corporations to accumulate more and more capital, and that capital translates into political power. So the extent to which, you know, we have a political system that stresses economic power over true democracy, we have a problem. So our goal is to look for opportunities to build more democracy so that democratic systems control economic decision-making. And we see examples of this all over the place in public health that have had benefits. We see certainly a great deal of frustration in the healthcare sector, where people are just recognizing the tsunami of obesity, chronic disease, diabetes, and recognizing that the traditional approaches aren't working, and that there are costs and consequences both to their systems in terms of their profitability, their own employees who are practicing now what is being referred to as presenteeism, being on the job but not being terribly productive,
mm-hmm.
and just the, you know, the natural inclination of people that are trained in science and in the professions to try to make a difference, and seeing themselves becoming frustrated with their inability to make a difference. So we've seen efforts on the part of health care systems, hospital systems, corporations coming to the table around public health and saying, you know what, these guys are making sense. We need to work with them to try to create essentially more democracy and to create opportunities for people to be able to thrive so that we have less of this this stress that accumulates in certain populations and in certain areas and leads to disease. Now, you can think of, and it's a little bit of a stretch for some people, but you can think of stress as being communicable.
Oh,
you know,
yes.
Just like tuberculosis
or
HIV or what have you. And that's the consequence of allowing it to percolate in various corners of a community, is that it spreads.
It's also used as a way to herd people. Fear.
Yes.
Anxiety,
yes,
and fear. It's a way of, it's sort of like having cattle dogs running around people, you know, herding them into a little clot and pushing them out of the way. It's in the news. I mean, it's all over the place. It's kind of the favorite mode of this particular administration, but it's being used far too much right now. Everybody's kind of in a state of hyperarousal.
Yes, but there are certain populations that, you know, independent of
fear-mongering
of the federal government and others.
Yeah, no, if you're a child,
chronic stress.
Yeah,
that chronic stress is communicable. It spills over. It infects whole communities and whole societies, and over time, it erupts. And so this is one of these pay me now or pay me later scenarios in which we can try to ignore this, see our international competitiveness continue to slide, see our burden of chronic disease and managing essentially less productive, less self-actuated populations continue to cost us more and more economically as well as socially and spiritually. We can sit there and watch this happen. And it will continue to spread. It will. By its nature, it's not containable within the walls of certain communities. And so we'll pay later on this. And at that point, it'll be much more difficult to afford. Now, you asked about good things, and I am an optimist, and I think that there are a lot of good things going on. I think most people understand this, and I think even people who are clearly benefiting in the short term recognize that this is basically a Faustian bargain. So I do think that the final thing that we're talking about doing, and this is, you know, amongst people who have been working on this for a while, I talked about working in communities, I talked about working on the policy landscape, but the final thing that we need to do is to have a conversation about values. What are fundamental American values? And to elucidate our priorities and our values in the society. And we don't have that conversation very often, which is why we can sort of gloss over the racism, the sexism, the classism, the discrimination against immigrants, the discrimination against people with disabilities, and think it's not me, it doesn't affect me. until we have a formal way of having those conversations and understanding that, you know, there are certain values that we cherish that are not being reflected in the policies that we're carrying out and the consequences of those policies, until we do this, we're going to continue to suffer from this burden of disease from unnatural causes. And I see all kinds of lights shining in various places around communities that have come together to have those kinds of conversations. And that's critical. It sounds touchy-feely, but it's absolutely critical.
No, it doesn't. It was well spoken. Incidentally, I've neglected to say you're listening to Dr. Anthony Iton, I-T-O-N. We're discussing longevity and socioeconomic stress, and this is Your Own Health and Fitness with Lena Berman. My observation is that the bulk of this is going to come from grassroots organizing, not from the government. I think there are people like you who are working to change policies, and that's absolutely critical. But I also think that this is a situation of people needing to stick their head up and take a look around to see what they can do to become involved. And in some cases, it may be as simple as just working in your own community to improve conditions.
I agree. This will not come from government. The government has absolutely no incentive to do this. Government is, by definition, the status quo. This will come from community. And I think what people that are interested can do is to organize. And I don't think writing a letter is enough here. I think you've got to get more organized in ways that build power. And then to use that power to demand that the process be accountable to all populations. I mean, you see it, around issues that are, current.
And critical.
And critical. And I think that access to health care happens to be one of them. And, despite everything that our data suggests, that health care is not the solution to health, it is a critical pillar in constructing a society that is committed to social justice. And when people are sick, they do need health care.
You said something very interesting, though, about one of the problems with the way we deliver health care now is that it shows up about 40 years too late.
Yeah, well,
it's delivered too late.
Again, when you look at the data, and it's too bad not more people look at the data, but when you look at the data, you see that when you look at a typical American lifespan from birth to death, interactions with the healthcare system occur primarily towards the sixth and seventh decade of life, when people are dealing with the consequences of chronic disease. And as an internist, I practiced, in settings where I was dealing with people who had a 40, 50-year head start on me, with their heart disease and their diabetes. And by the time they came to see me, I had very little opportunity to reverse, 3, 4, 5 decades of sedentary lifestyle, chronic disease, smoking, and stress. And so to think that the healthcare system as a solution or a tool can be applied to all situations, including relieving stress in communities, looking at workplace stress, that's another issue that comes up in unnatural causes, the high-demand, low-control jobs, and the amount of stress that generates in people's lives chronically. The healthcare system can't solve that, but the policy arena can make significant improvements in the quality of people's lives. And you only have to look at some other countries around the world, how they've approached this consciously, and seen the consequences in terms of reduction in stress in people's lives and the concomitant increase in life expectancy.
I do want very much, though, for Western medicine to back off a little bit on standard of care and individualize these situations with people, and also maybe use medication as a last resort, because I'm seeing now, as I mentioned to you when we talked, the medicalization of symptoms where people with, I think, really normal cholesterol are now being slapped on drugs, and there's some potential health effects from doing that down the line. So there's kind of again, this is another corporation running over us, which is the pharmaceutical industry, which is last time I looked, has more money than even the petroleum industry. So I'm concerned about the delivery of healthcare, and that's something I talk about on the air. But I also think that a portion of healthcare is what I remember as a child, which was that you actually had a relationship with your family doctor, and they might even just come over if a kid was sick. I remember one instance where our family doctor came over. I know this doesn't exist in populations at risk, although it could, that the doctor would come, and sometimes the situation was just some talking that would happen. But there's no, I mean, one of the things that communities that are immigrant communities in their own communities, what they have is this sense of extended family, and even people who are not considered experts, but who are considered to have talent at healing, who come in and confer with people and help. And that sometimes is more helpful than anything else that can be delivered.
Yes, and I think that, again, speaks to this notion of stress and how do you relieve stress. And feeling connected to culture and to community is a clear benefit.
And local knowledge.
Stress.
Local knowledge also. The fact that some people actually do know what to do and have gotten frightened out of it.
And I just, in defense of doctors...
No, I don't mean to attack.
I just do want to say that most doctors like practicing medicine that way and want to practice medicine that way. And a culture has grown up in medicine that has nothing to do with the interests of physicians, but has to do with the interests of corporations.
Well, and also people are now seeing commercials for medications, and they're going, oh, look at that. I could take that. You know, so that they probably come in looking for that, and that's frustrating for doctors who may actually be healers, who may actually want to participate in this. So it's kind of a bad system for everybody. It's not a very relaxing situation for doctors, too. I think that's a very high-stress position to be in as well.
Yeah, and many doctors are leaving.
They are indeed. Yes, they are.
Particularly primary care doctors who are interested in forming relationships and actually being more the healer than the scientist.
So I'm going to have to sort of slowly end this interview. Unfortunately, you've been a wonderful guest. Give us again the name of the organization that you've been working with.
It's called the Bay Area Regional Health Inequities Initiative, or BARHI. It's a product of the Public Health Institute. You can find BARHI on the web at www.barhii.org.
Great.
Or if I'm wrong about that, which I don't think I am,
you just Google it.
PHI.org.
Oh, okay, PHI.
PublicHealthInstitute.org.
And you can also go to unnaturalcauses.org for articles and things.
And you can go to the Alameda County Public Health Department website, acphd.org, for any of our data reports and PowerPoint presentations. They're available to anybody who wants them.
And I will post that on our website. Dr. Eitan, I thank you so much for your generosity and your work.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. There's information about your own health and fitness, our guests, our practice, the Progressive Health Observer, a free stream of this week's show, and lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org. Our information number is 707-874-2772. And there is information about forming local chapters and more at sustainablehealthinstitute.org. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Lena Berman and Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.